It's good to be with you again for another Sunday morning at Yankton. For us, it's always a privilege to come back every several years when we have the opportunity. We actually came back to the States in June of last year, amidst all the COVID. We were supposed to take a one-year furlough at that time, but things have slowed down and things have been shut down. And so when we actually go back, it's kind of uncertain. But we're tentatively planning on going back in the fall sometime, so if the Lord directs, we have some family issues to take care of, and all the COVID things that's happening in Brazil, all these things are kind of making us unsure of what's actually going to happen. But we trust the Lord in all those things. Many of you may have heard about Manaus, about Brazil, and some of those places. It's one of the first places in Brazil there to have just a hard hit with COVID, and the whole medical system, the hospitals collapsed. People dying everywhere in mass graves, and they were running out of coffins in the city, and then later on a second wave hit with a new variant, and many people died from that, and they ran out of oxygen in the city. And so it's kind of been described as worse than chaos. It's just been a nightmare for being there in Brazil. So there's been a lot of suffering. There's been a lot of people that we know that have died, and a lot of family members and pastors and friends that have gone through some situations. So it's been a kind of a hard, rough time to see all that happening. But the Lord is in control, and we trust it, and in His way, in His direction, that He'll work all things out. So that's the kind of the message this morning is trusting in the Lord amidst all these different things, you know, that happened to us. I don't know if some of you may be new to us since the last time we were here. So just a little background on who we are and what we do. We're Jeff and Judy. We work with a mission called New Tribes Mission of Brazil. It's Ethnos 360 here is the new name here in the States. We've been there for about 30 years, a little over 30 years. The first 10 years we worked out in the jungle with an indigenous group called the Mayaduna people. And then the last 20 years, we've been involved in administration in our headquarters in Manaus for the Amazon region. We have about 200 missionaries that we work with, and we have a staff in Manaus of about 25 people or so. And we work with about 25 different indigenous groups in the Amazon area. There's many more. There's about 50 altogether that the mission works with in Brazil. But in the Amazon area, we're primarily responsible for. There's about 25 different groups with different languages and different cultures and different locations. So that's our ministry, is helping them in any way that we can. Judy's involved in the consulting department where we guide in a certain way. We help, instruct, and give the tools, the resources necessary for the missionary to accomplish his goals there in the different locations. And so we're just a part of that, and we serve in many different roles and do many different things in that way. But our objective is the same, is to see the Word of God get into the hands of the people out in these remote, isolated areas, and churches being planted out there in the name of God, honored and glorified out in those, in all those locations. So it's a real privilege to be a part of that. And oftentimes we don't see a lot of results, but the Lord knows all those things, and the work goes slow. But there are some incredible testimonies that we've seen and heard over the years too. So it's been encouraging. I often say that, you know, life on the mission field isn't easy, but some of the hardest things are some of the basic things that we all face with. And some of the things, the hardest thing is that being able to trust God in all situations. Being able to trust God when it comes down to all of a sudden a crisis appears, then it really comes down to the point of where that trust really is. And that happened to us here just a few years back, since we've been here the last time, is one of those phone calls that you don't like to get. And we got a call from one of the different locations out in the jungle from one of the payphones out there, saying that one of our missionaries, he didn't come home last night. He went out in the jungle to go hunt with the men, and he didn't make it back home. We think he might be lost. So sometimes it happens to all of us when life is going good and all of a sudden something happens and everything kind of changes. Well, for Vladimir, who was his name, he was a Brazilian fellow, one of our single missionaries that works with the Dene people. And he had gone out. They're having a wedding for one of the families there in the tribal area. And so all the men, customarily, they go out and they hunt together to get all the food for that wedding feast coming up for the next day. And so Vladimir, he's a part of that too. So the men had taken off, and as he was thinking, so I just did some washing laundry down the, down at the river, and he wanted to get that up and hang and dry before he took off. And so he said, "You guys go on ahead, I'll meet you at the meeting place. I'm just gonna hang out his clothes and all that kind of stuff real quick." So he did that, and he grabbed his little knife and his sandals and the kind of little t-shirt and whatever. He was just kind of planning on a little, one day adventure, going out and coming right back again and meeting with the guys. And so as he went down the trail, there was a big tree that had fallen down several hours down the way. There was a big tree that had fallen down, so he wanted to go around the tree. And as he kept on going, he kind of realized that he'd kind of lost the trail. And as he went back, and he just lost his way. And so here he was, without really prepared for any kind of incident, with just a kind of a small knife and some thongs and just shorts and a t-shirt kind of deal. Little did he know that it was going to be 9 days wandering out in that jungle before he was able to find his way back. And so we got the call in Manaus about Vladimir. And our experiences with people getting lost, we didn't have them very often, but we had a few instances like that, and it's a pretty scary feeling. In our tribe where we worked at, there was one of the Indians that got lost for 6 months before he was able to find his way back. And so it's a pretty common thing, and there's no guarantees that you're going to be able to make it back. Quite a few people do die doing it that. For one thing, the jungle is incredibly immense. The canopy is so thick that there's no openings at all whatsoever. You really can't see where sunset and sunrise is for your direction. All you can do is sometimes see what's overhead before you get the idea of the sun is. And so all these things complicated. And so as we started figuring out what we were going to do with Vladimir, he's a long ways away from us in a remote location. He's by himself. And we don't know a lot of things that are going on. And so we start the first process of what we're going to do. We call 911, the number's there. And boy, it'd sure be nice if the search and rescue team would just take charge and take care of that for us, with the helicopter or whatever, but that's just not the case. But when we started going on and working with this, we put in some long hours for all those days, trying to make this rescue operation happen. You talk about everything that could go wrong during one of these things. That was one of those things. For one thing, he was by himself and none of his co-workers were there. So we needed to, so as soon as they knew, they wanted to get there as soon as possible to help, to see if they could be a part of that. So it was a 6-hour drive for them, and then the airplane flight, another hour and a half airplane flight to get into the tribe where he's at. Well, normally we have a fixed-wing aircraft, but that fixed-wing it was a float plane that would fly in there right into the tribe. But that fixed-wing airplane happened to be on maintenance, so it wasn't available anymore, and all they had was a regular fixed-gear aircraft. And so for that aircraft to be able to land, it had to go 8 hours downriver to the closest landing strip to get to there. So these guys had to fly in and then go to this airstrip and then go 8 hours by boat just to get to the village where they're at. Well, with that, then you have to have a boat, then you have to have gasoline and all the stuff that goes with it to bring that in with you. So things kind of started getting a little more complicated all the way. So they got in there and they went and they searched the area and they found some tracks, but he wasn't anywhere to be found. Well, we found out later that first night, the Indians knew that they were supposed to meet with him at a certain rendezvous point, and he didn't show up. And so they kind of figured he was lost. And so what they did is they started up a chainsaw, and they were making a loud noise, which you can hear a long ways away, so that Vladimir, you'd be able to hear this sound and be able to get to him and they'd find him right away.
But Vladimir, he's had malaria for 40 times, and the medicine has kind of had him a little hard of hearing. So he was hearing something, but he figured, who would be running a chainsaw at this time of the night? So he just discarded it and thought, well, it's probably just his hearing that's going bad and messing with him. So he didn't pay any attention to that help at all. And so the process began. It was Vladimir in his mind. He knows what happens in these indigenous cultures most of the time, that if you get lost or you lose your way, because everybody's out hunting all the time out in the jungle. But if somebody happens to get lost, it's kind of you're on your own to get back. Because if you other people start going out for you, it just kind of complicates things. You get more people lost and more things to worry about. And so he knew that basically nobody's going to be coming after him, and it was just his responsibility to find his way back. And he figured he knew where he was, and he figured, well, I'll just get back, soon. So the first night passed. He said, well, by tomorrow I'll be back home and be no problem at all. The second night, it was the same thing. He says, well, he thought he was going the right direction, and he says, well, I'll just be back by tomorrow, so he wasn't too worried. Well, the third night happened again, and he was kind of thinking that same thing. Well, surely I should be towards the village. I'm going in the right direction. And that didn't happen either. And all of a sudden, he kind of started thinking, I wonder if I'm going the right direction. And then he kind of figured out that he wasn't. So this whole area is about 400 square miles that we're looking in. We knew that this area that we needed to search for him was, this whole area. And there was big swamp area to the south, and kind of a river to the west, and a river to the north, and kind of other landmarks towards the east. So we know that he would be able to identify those places, at least kind of be in that kind of a general area. So we had to cover about 400 square miles of land to find him. One of the encouraging things was, that while Vladimir didn't expect that any of the indigenous people would be looking for him, in fact, the opposite was occurring. These guys, there's about 20 of them, and these men, and says, we're not coming back out of this jungle until we find him. That's how much they appreciated and respected Vladimir being out there. Vladimir, of course, he never really knew that. Most of the time, you're just living your life, and you don't even realize even people even care about it until you get into trouble, then you realize when people come in and how much they do appreciate it. But these guys had made this commitment, we're not coming out of this jungle until we find him and track him down. So it started off with these guys. In the meantime, we've been trying to contact the authorities to get them to help us in a certain way. And also kind of the runaround. Well, call them, maybe they can help you, or call this other department, maybe they can help you. We were kind of looking for a helicopter that we could fly directly into there and be able to search for that. And there was helicopters sitting on the pad, but no, we don't do that kind of stuff with helicopters. And so it was kind of the runaround, pushing here from one other department to one other department. And a day or two had passed, and finally we went over to the search and rescue department there in Manaus, and personally, because they weren't responding to any telephone calls. And the guy says, well, we don't have any aircraft. We really can't do it too much, but we can give you three guys if that'll help at all. And these guys had three GPS. They had GPS, and so that was their tools that they had. The indigenous people, they're wizards out in the jungle. They don't need any GPS, and they're just as good with that. So we didn't know how much of it helped, but at least the government was involved, and we knew that any help would be appreciated. And so they said, we'll give you the three men if you do all the logistics of getting them into the tribe for us. So that ended up being quite a bit bigger job than we even predicted, because we couldn't get any aircraft, and so there was another mission aircraft that would be able to fly them. But the aircraft was so big that it couldn't fly to the smaller airstrip. It only had to land in a bigger airstrip in a smaller town. So then we had to get all them settled by the smaller aircraft, getting back and forth, and had to make several trips to get them with all their gasoline, with all their food supplies, and getting this all worked out. And so by the time these guys finally made it to the village, it was another 2 days that passed just to get all the logistics to get these men up in the village. And these three men, once they got in and they were part of the team working, by that time people were calling other villages to come and help in the search. And so we started getting more and more people coming into the search. And the fire department, which is the search and rescue team, they started organizing things, taking a section of time, and kind of kept working their way north so they'd make sure they wouldn't leave any land that wasn't uncovered. And so they kind of started working that process, and after about 2 days, these three firemen came down and said, we're completely worn out, we can't handle any more of this, going, working about 20 miles a day, cutting through the jungle and doing this kind of stuff, and says, we need reinforcements. And so then we had to do the whole process over again, trying to get more men in, and they'd get reports back, hey, we found some tracks, but they never could find anybody. So we were always hopeful, but we just never knew what was going to happen. The chances are, as the days kept going by, that probably we weren't going to be able to find Vladimir alive. And so all these things, we were hopeful, but yet we didn't know what was going to happen. We were dependent on a little boat, a little outboard motor. They had to make the trips every day to do it, all the shuttling, all that kind of stuff, bringing in the gas to make sure they had plenty of gas. And this boat kept giving us problems. And so they called on the radios, and another team was coming in. We're trying to fly them in for help, for more. And they says, we need a boat park. This keeps breaking down, and if this boat goes down, we're in trouble. And so we called the big major city, the capital city, looked all over for that with the pilot, and couldn't find that boat park anywhere. We called the other smaller towns, trying to find anything that would work, any kind of use thing, any kind of a jump thing that would help. Nowhere to be found could we find this park. It was kind of par for everything that was happening. Everything that we tried, it just wasn't working. And so finally we just said, we can't find it anywhere. We're just going to have to go in and send you the gas and do what we can and go from that. So more days passed, more men coming in. And so at this point we had about 60 men out there searching for him. And it got down to the last day, and they were giving us a call. This was the eighth day, and says, this is our last section that we're ready to cover. It says, we're pretty sure we're going to find him in this next day. And so we didn't know what was going to happen. And so we were just hoping that he was still alive, somewhere. The pilot, as he was flying over, he had seen a jaguar along the river's edge. And so we know that, those are the kind of main predators out there that we need to be cautious about. And Vladimir, he was pretty cautious about that too. In fact, he didn't want to sleep at night. He sat up with a tree, with the back against a tree, to try to protect himself as much as possible, and did sleep a lot during the night. But he was able to find food and to find water enough to keep him going. Of course, his clothes were kind of torn to shreds. His thongs had kind of come apart, and he wasn't using any of that. His feet were full of thorns as he was walking through the jungle. He had found a little creek. It kind of gave him some orientation, and so he followed this creek until it kind of turned into a big swamp, and he was walking up into his waist in this muck in the swamp. He says, I can't do this anymore. And so he decided just to head off straight north on highland. And so the trackers, they found his tracks at one point along this creek, and all of a sudden they lost him again, and they didn't know where he was. And so all the different confusions were, if he just would have known people were following him, and he would have stayed in one place, it would have made it so much easier, but he was always just a step ahead of him, each day. Vladimir finally got to the main river running along the north, and he was got there just in the late afternoon, and he could hear the boats as they were going back along the river. It's 20 miles going from the village to the other rendezvous point for the team as they'd search and they'd go back. So it's a 20-mile stretch of river that they were going up and forth all the time. So as they were coming back, he heard the boat motors going, but he yelled and whatever, but with all the noise of the boats, they couldn't hear him at all, and they just drove right on by. And so he thought he'd try to swim out in the water to get their attention. And he was so weak and everything, and as the jungle kind of overgrows along the river's edge, you can't get along the riverside. You kind of way back up in the trees, and so you really can't see you from the river's edge. And so he said, this isn't going to work either. And so he just went back, and he said, well, I'm just going to have to end up walking back, through the, at least he knew where he was, and he was heading the right direction, but he was still about 10 miles away, from the village and going that way. The next morning, all of a sudden, he heard the boat motors going again in the distance, coming by here, and he just did, know anything what to do. And all of a sudden, the boat motor stopped. This part that's given them problems all along stopped at a certain point, and the men in the boat heard a voice, "Hey, I'm over here!" And they were able to find him at that point, and of course the boat motor started right up again as they were able to track down, and we got the report on the little inReach tracker. It says, "We found him, and he's alive and well." So we praise the Lord for what he was doing. It was one of those things that, you know, was frustrated to find this boat part, and we figured, you know, it's just one of those things that just goes wrong. But we were so thankful we did find that boat part, because the boat failed at the certain time where it needed to fail. And we knew that God, and all of his purposes, that he had everything in control and all the things. That just one more example of how God showed himself to be strong in that situation. This is a story that around Brazil, it went out all over the nation. Churches were praying for him. It went out around the world for our different missions and missionaries and all that kind of stuff. And it was a real example of the Lord taking care of his people and the Lord answering prayer. And so it was a real show of God's faithfulness in the whole situation. So we look back, well, it was easy to trust the Lord, you know, that he's going to do something. But we just didn't know if the Lord was going to do it in the way that we wanted to do, you know. And that's when it comes about, and it talks about trusting the Lord. And in Isaiah 40, the real common verse that, you know, that all of us know, that we all go to and relate to, and that are the most popular verse, that those that trust upon the Lord, those that wait upon the Lord, shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. You know, and it's such a good verse, but it kind of has that tendency, it's, you know, that I come out good in the end, and this kind of thing. It looks good, you know, that God was faithful and trustful. But sometimes it doesn't always happen that way. That God is always going to do it in the way that I want him to do it. And so when these situations come, trusting the Lord, it really gets to be a pretty tough thing. We just don't know exactly what he has in mind. But the rest of the chapter of Isaiah 40, it kind of puts things into perspective a little bit on the last verse of what we get to say. And so that's kind of what I'd like to focus a little bit on this morning, is that trust upon the Lord, and really where our heart is at, because we all really trust in something. There's certain things where life is kind of easy, and things are kind of in our control, and things that we can do, we can kind of trust in those things and do what we can. But the things that are completely out of our control, those are the things that kind of make us a little nervous and a little unsure of what God has in mind and what he's going to do. So Isaiah 40, in the context of this verse, or this chapter, is kind of interesting, because as we kind of look into it, it looks like this is a point of time when God is going to be leading the people into captivity into Babylon. It's going to be the age of the Gentiles. It's going to be starting. And things for the Jews are going to start getting pretty bad. From that point on until Jesus comes again, it's going to be kind of rough for the Jews. And it's starting where at this point in time, that God is going to be working with the Gentiles during this time. And then he talks about the beginning, and he talks about the end, where fear not, that God will fill salvation at the end. And encourage yourself with these words. But the thing is all the in-between time, when you don't really know what the Lord is going to do during all these captivity times, during all this slavery times and all this kind of things, it's really easy to question and doubt, what is God really doing in their lives and in my life? But the Lord gave a little help to help them to prepare themselves for all the things that would take place in their life. And it's got help for us too, as we think about certain things and the things that we face. And so the things that we trust in, God put it into this way in chapter 40. He uses comparisons. So if you're going to trust in something, who are you going to compare God to. The things that you trust in compared to God. These are the comparisons that he makes. So there was four or five different areas that he mentioned. And I'm going to read in this New Living Translation. The verses that he talks about in chapter 40. Who are you going to compare God to? He says, who else has held the ocean in his hand? Who has measured off the heavens with his fingers? Who else knows the weight of the earth or has weighed the mountains and hills on a scale? Who is able to advise the Spirit of the Lord? Who knows enough to give him advice or teach him? Has the Lord ever needed anyone's advice? Does he need instruction about what is good? Did someone teach him what is right or show him the path of justice? As I was thinking about this first section that here, who do we compare God to? When it looked about, when it talks about, you know, all this information about this knowledge and you know, the weight of the earth, the size of the oceans, and the length of this and that. Well, you know, one of the things that we really worship in America is our scientists, our science. You know, they're such smart people. They know all the answers for this. They've figured out this. They know how to do this. And basically our world is, we honor, we worship those scientists, and what they say is amazing. And, you know, if they can tell us this and we're going to follow that, and what the doctors and what the, you know, the intelligent people tell us, they've got to be true and they've got to be accurate. So they're our hope and what we can base our lives off of what they say. You know, God says, you know, you compare my knowledge to their knowledge. You know, these guys had to be instructed. Somebody had to teach them. But who instructed God to know all these things? Can our smartest scientists, can they still tell us what the exact weight of the earth is? The distance of the heavens? I mean, we've got theories and speculations and all that kind of stuff. But reality is the science of all the knowledge that we have compared to God. Does it really even come close to that kind of knowledge? You know, so where is our trust? Are we really trusting in science to give us all the help and the hope that we need? God says our trust, the real trust, isn't in those kind of things. He moves into the second point in verses 15 to 17. He talks about the nations, for all the nations of the world are but a drop in the bucket. They are nothing more than dust on the scales. He picks up the whole earth as though it were a grain of sand. All the wood in Lebanon's forests and all the Lebanon's animals would not be enough to make a burnt offering worthy of our God. The nations of the world are worth nothing to him. In his eyes they count for less than nothing, mere emptiness and froth. Well, I don't know, it seems to me like when you watch the news, it's all about the nations is what our hope is about, you know. Powers coming up and dominating this and taking care of this and nations fighting against nations and wars and different things happening, and we look to the government for our hope, for answers, to provide for us, to take care of our needs, for justice, for all these different things. Our hope is in our government to do the right thing. And when our government doesn't do the right thing, then maybe despair or fear or uncertainty comes in, and what's going to happen to the future of all these things that are taking place. Now we depend on our government to take care of us and provide for us. But in God's eyes, when we start comparing God to our government, you know, the great and the powerful United States of America is just a drop in the bucket. It says it's nothing more than dust on the scale. Has anybody ever measured how much a dust on the scale weighs? It's nothing. So as we know that our government is so important and all the things that are happening in the world are so important to his government, but it's compared to God, it's still nothing. Where is our trust and our hope? To whom can you compare God? He moves into this other section, verses 19 to 20. Can he be compared to an idol formed in a mold, overlaid with gold and decorated with silver and chains? Or if people are too poor for that, they might at least choose wood that, that doesn't decay, and a skilled craftsman to carve an image that won't fall down. Idols, you know, back in those times were as a symbol of security, of being blessed, of being of well-being, you know. So for security and that kind of stuff, money is kind of what we base our hope on. Is that as long as we got a lot of money and things that'll take care of us in our house, that's our security. But as he talks about in here, you better make sure that you choose an idol, you choose something that you're secure about that's not going to rot. You don't want it to fall down, because that's not going to be a good sign. You know, if you choose something that's putting all your hope on these certain things that gives you security, and all of a sudden it doesn't pull through for you, well, that's not a good sign. Because you need something that's going to be sure in every kind of situation. So even the idols in those point that... You know, if you just, how do you compare that to a God that doesn't fail, to something that rots and corrupts and it doesn't last? From everything that we consider to be secure, that it fails. It says, haven't you heard? Don't you understand? Are you deaf to the words of God, the words he gave before the world began? Are you so ignorant? These things that we want to trust in compared to God that he's saying that don't be fooled by what they have to offer. Verses 22 to 24. God sits above the circle of the earth. The people below him seem like grasshoppers to him. He spreads out the heavens like a curtain and makes his tent from them. He judges the great people of the world and brings them all to nothing. They hardly get started, barely taking root when he blows on them, and they wither and the wind carries them off. This other section, he talks about the great people. Movers and shakers of our society, the important people. They make things happen, the people you depend on, the presidents, the powerful people, the idols, the great athletes, the great movie stars, the musicians and the rock stars, the people that are put up on pedestals and worshipped as, oh, they're so great, they're so good. And the world pays so much attention to them, and yet the Lord says to, as he looks down above, and they're just like grasshoppers. They come and go so fast, and really they aren't really that important as we consider them to be important. Trusting in those people to do the things for us or to meet our needs, the futility in that, the God is saying, and that doesn't work either. And to finish it off in the last section here, verses 26 to 27, he says, to whom will you compare me? Who is my equal? Ask the Holy One. Look up into the heavens. Who created all the stars? He brings them out like an army, one after another, calling each by its name. Because of his great power and incomparable strength, not a single one is missing. O Jacob, how can you say the Lord does not see your troubles? O Lord, how can you say God ignores your rights? Have you never understood? Have you never heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of all the earth. One of the common thought, the tendency that we have is to think that God has forgotten about me. When these crises comes and the moment comes when the floor is taken away from underneath me and everything is gone and wondering what is going on. And the questions and the outcomes is that, you know, where is God at this time? Is he not powerful enough to take care of all these situations? And once again, he uses his strength and power in nature as he shows the forces of nature, all that's in his control. And when you look at all that, and he says, how can you say that I don't see your troubles? Am I not powerful enough to care about you? How can you say that I ignore you and all these things when I call each star by name? The thing is the question of the real trust that we have in these situations and the things that we face. And as he finishes it up, that he's the one that gives power, he's the one that gives strength. The youths, in all their efforts to try to control their lives, they will become weak and tired. Young men will fall in exhaustion, but the ones who trust in the Lord will find the strength that they need. And so it's one of those things, and no matter where we're at in this world, the trust in the Lord is certainly not an easy thing, especially when things get really tough and we don't really know what the Lord has in store for us, whether it's going to turn out good the way we want it to be or whether it's going to turn out in a different way. Those things are not us for us to know. But God does say that when you trust in Him, that He will not let you down, that everything will be according to His way and things are in His control. So those are the things that keeps us going in the midst of the hard things. With Elijah Muir, he had no idea what was going to happen. We had no idea what was going to happen. We prayed constantly. The Lord answered our prayers. And we knew at the end that it was the Lord that made all things happen to save Elijah Muir. One of the things is that we were prepared, you know, to find him dead somewhere too. And we would have known that would have been God's purpose as well. And as we look back until the end of time, back in Revelation chapter 5, where it gives us a picture of the church being in heaven, of everybody gathered around the omnipotent God, we see the picture of God still sitting on the throne. And the question comes in chapter 5 is he worthy to open the scroll? And that's kind of the point where we're at in our world today is that we don't really know, is Jesus really worthy? Is he really worthy to meet all of our needs? If we follow him, is he going to take care of our lives? Is he going to do what he wants to do in our lives? Is he going to work everything out for good? Those things are the questions that we have because we see all the problems and the needs and all these kind of different things. And even at this point in Revelation 5 where the church is raptured in and sitting up there all together with all the saints of all times, of all the Old Testament prophets, and everybody's around. And the question is there, is he worthy? And there was silence. And you start picking out, you know, all these important people of all the important prophets in the past and the important leaders and even of our time, famous pastors and all the people. And there was silence. It was... Who is worthy to do all, to meet all the needs, to conquer the sin problems, to resolve all these problems? And it was so emotional that John began to cry. He was just so overwhelmed with the emotion that nobody's coming up to, who's going to take care of all the problems that we have? All of a sudden, Jesus appears on the scene coming through and takes the scroll. And then from that moment on, everything changed. They started singing and started worshiping and say, he is worthy. At that point, at the beginning, before that, it was the question was, is he worthy? Following is Jesus, trusting him with our lives and doing that, is it? We don't really know if it's going to work out because the sin just seems to be overwhelming, overtaking everything. But as soon as he takes the scroll, all of a sudden things change. And not one person that you can see there was doubts anymore. Everybody's saying, he is worthy. And they were singing and worshiping him. After that moment, there was not a doubt at all that it was all worth it. And Jesus was the one. And so those are the assurances that we have, is that although we don't understand what God is doing, that he has the beginning foreknown and the ending foreknown and all things in between are all in his control. And those are the things, the promises that we rest on and the trust that we have to help us in each of our daily situations. So, our missionary life and serving in Brazil, we thank the Lord for that, but we know that anything that we've ever done or hope to accomplish or anything, it's going to be the Lord that uses us in His way, in His timing, and His blessing. And so, we thank you for your part in being standing with us, for praying for us. We know you do that. You support us financially, have been doing that faithfully for many years. And so we thank you, thank the Lord for you and all you've done and being part of the ministry there in Brazil too. And when we get to heaven and sitting at the throne and rejoicing together, we'll understand all these things, but at the meantime, we'll just keep trusting the Lord and keep moving forward. So thank you again for the opportunity of being here this morning.